Professor Jeffrey Frieden from Harvard University spoke at an ASR Absolute Exchange lunch on September the 13th of this year. As a professor of political economy at the university's Department of Government, Professor Frieden drew on his research on the economic history of the United States as it struggled to form its own single currency and applied it to what we know about the European project. This is Jeffrey Frieden.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and you should all go ahead and eat. I had an enormous breakfast and won't be eating anything. So just if I can talk while you're eating, it'll give me more time to talk. I warned Michael and David and others that it was dangerous to ask me to talk about American economic history because I could do that for a very, very long period of time. So it'll be up to them to pull me back to the present. But I do want to situate this in the context, as has been said, of waiting for the results of the German election, not because we don't know the results, but because what happens in German domestic politics, what happens in Germany more broadly, is crucial to the forward movement in the process of resolution of what I think is Europe's central issue, which is how to create a union that provides monetary and fiscal stability. Now, everybody is in favor of monetary and fiscal stability, so why should it be difficult to arrive at that? I think the answer is a simple one, which is that there are various terms on which monetary and fiscal stability can be delivered, and this is a problem in any economic union. There are typically a common set of overarching goals, otherwise there wouldn't be a union, and there are differences of opinion, and underlying those differences of opinion, differences of interest with respect to the particulars of how those goals should be achieved. A simple way of thinking about the divisions within any kind of union, within any political environment on monetary, fiscal, financial terms is, on the one hand, you've got a group of people who are in favor of easy money and easy credit, and typically these are those who are in rapidly growing areas who want to be able to expand more easily, or those who find themselves as debtors in a current context. So this, in the American setting, these are the folks who are associated with the position called easy money, which meant more expansionary monetary policy, more pro-debtor financial policies, more expansionary pro-debtor fiscal policies. And then on the other side, you have those typically in the more stable regions or segments of the economy, and who tend to be more on the creditor side, who want what in the American parlance was called and is still called hard money. That is, more conservative monetary policies, more conservative fiscal policies, and more pro-creditor financial policies. Right? Now, I am very, very happy to talk about the American experience, the early American experience, both in its own right, because I think it's fascinating, but also for more general and perhaps analogical or metaphorical purposes, because I'm a great believer in what Mark Twain once said, which is history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. That is, there are parallels that we can draw between historical experience and contemporary problems. And I think the American example is of great importance and of great relevance to the problems that both the European Union and other fiscal and financial and monetary unions are facing. The U.S. is always given, or often given, as an example of a very successful monetary and fiscal union. We have solved the problem of responding to correlated exogenous shocks. We have a common monetary policy. We have a series of automatic stabilizers that deal with interregional variation. We have labor mobility and mobility of capital. We have a banking union with common regulatory considerations, which deal with all sorts of problems that arise in the financial system. The celebration of this successful union often ignores the fact that it really is only in place in the 1930s, if you're optimistic, the 1950s, if you're a bit more realistic. That is, the completion of the American monetary, fiscal, and financial union is a relatively recent phenomenon. Right? Certainly, before 1913, it was all but incomplete. That is, there was no central bank. And what I'm going to talk about today is a period that goes back even before then, where there are massive macroeconomic divergences among the regions of the country, where there are extraordinarily uncoordinated and indeed not only uncoordinated but contradictory fiscal policies on the part of the member states of the union, where there is a highly fragmented set of bank regulations, with some states pursuing extremely conservative and restrictive regulatory policies and other states pursuing essentially no regulatory policies at all. So I want to go back to the beginnings of the American Union to talk and explore some of these economic and political events when many of the problems first arose and were confronted by the American Union. And to talk a little bit about, and what I'm going to do here is turn off the clock, the phone part, and just leave it as a clock so I can make at least a stab at not going too far, too long before running out of time. Go back to the beginning of the American Union to explore some of these economic and political events during which time these problems were confronted, and we move towards a resolution, both on its own right, but also to clarify some of the tensions that arise in a union of this sort. Now, the American Revolution was financed largely, as most wars and certainly revolutions are financed, by inflationary means. The Continental Congress, which was the representative agent of the 13 colonies, issued a currency called the Continental Currency, which has gone down into history first and foremost, and really only, in the expression worthless as a continental, which Americans still use. Now, this is a $50 continental bill, which was worth, in most of the period in which it was issued, something between 25 cents and 75 cents. This chart here shows the face and specie value of outstanding continental value. It looks pretty good until you realize that the left axis, which is the face value, is 10 times the right axis, which is the specie value, the value in gold or silver. So what that means is that at the peak there, $200 million worth of continental currency was in circulation, and it was worth in 1780 about $3 or $4 million. So 2.5-3% of par value, of the face value, right? So the continental currency was essentially worthless, and the new administration, the new government, had to face the problems associated with having a currency that was worthless. The only thing that circulated in this period, the real money that circulated, was foreign currency, mostly Spanish silver dollars or pieces of eight. Which is why Americans still talk about things like two bits, which is two pieces of a piece of eight, the old Spanish dollar. The problems were addressed by my hero, Alexander Hamilton, who was the founder of the Bank of New York and the person who established the New York public water system, which is one of the great wonders of the world, in my view. And undoubtedly, in my view, the most intelligent member of the group of founding fathers that set up the Republic in the 1770s. In 1780s. He was appointed Secretary of the Treasury in 1790. In 1790, he wrote two of the founding tracts of all, I think, modern political economy, the Report on Manufactures and the Report on the Public Credit. He first addressed the monetary problem. And recognizing that you could not have competing currencies and that a government required a central bank, he established the first bank of the United States. Now, which always reminds me of my undergraduates who say, how did they know it was World War I at the time? They didn't actually call it the first bank of the United States. They called it the Bank of the United States because they didn't know there was going to be a second one. Set up in 1791 in Philadelphia. This is the building, still there. It's a national monument. That Bank of the United States had the right to issue notes, which it did, and it eventually didn't get a monopoly of note issue, but essentially its notes became the money of the United States. It had important regulatory powers over other banks. It was a lender of last resort, and it set an incipient monetary policy for the Federal Union. It was based in Philadelphia, was not insignificant. Philadelphia was, along with New York and Boston, the commercial and financial center of the country. The bank was controlled by what were regarded at the time the more conservative financial and commercial elites in the big northeastern cities. This is a national bank note issued by the Bank of the United States in 1798. $10 at the time is a lot of money. The per capita income was about $65 a year. So $10 was, this would have been a note that was issued to a merchant or to one of the states, or to one of the banks to be held in reserve, right? And these notes, these bank notes, were essentially as good as gold. They were backed by the full faith and credit of the government and by a very substantial foreign currency and gold reserve. So the Bank of the United States solves the monetary problem. But there's a big fiscal problem as well. During the Revolution, or as I think you like to call it, the War for Independence, both the Continental Congress, the federal government, which was not federal at that point, but the Continental Congress and the states borrowed very heavily. So there was money issue, and there was either implicit or explicit borrowing. The implicit borrowing was they often requisitioned goods from farmers or manufacturers and paid them in scrip, which was to be repaid at some future date and essentially became like debt. And for all intents and purposes, both the central government and the states were in continual default on their debts to either their explicit creditors, that is Dutch, French, Spanish, and domestic creditors who had lent money to the states or to the central government, or the suppliers who were owed money by the states and central government. This is Hamilton from the Report on Public Credit, primarily talking about the national debt. So you have these debts in default. And Hamilton proposes something which is incredibly controversial, and in which he was almost certainly in a tiny minority within both the government and the society as a whole, which is to recognize these debts and essentially pay them off. Not at face value, but at something close to face value. So remember, so you have debts of the state of Georgia, which are trading at 0.5 cents on the dollar, right? Because they're worthless. And Hamilton proposes that the federal government, the new federal government, because this is after the Constitution is adopted and put in place in 1789, this is 1790-91. Hamilton proposes that the new federal government will assume the debts of the states and pay them off. Not at face value necessarily, but at something approaching face value. And his argument is, this is a terrible thing to do from a moral standpoint, because most of these debts are not now held by the people that we borrow the money from. Most of these are held by what we would now call vulture capitalists, by people who are buying up this worthless debt at a penny on the dollar in the hopes that they'll get something out of it. So morally and ethically, there's no justification for this, Hamilton says. However, it's the only way we have to establish confidence in the willingness and ability of our new federal government to honor its debts, to honor its obligations, right? This is an extraordinarily controversial policy. It takes Hamilton a year and a half to convince George Washington, the new president, and eventually members of the Congress and the Senate, that this is the right thing to do. His principal argument is, without assuming these debts, we will never gain access to international financial markets. We will never again be able to borrow from the Dutch, who are our principal creditors. And that will be a terrible thing. We won't be able to finance any future debts. Jefferson is dead set against this, Jefferson being the leader of the pro-debtor group in Congress. Hamilton, the leader of the pro-creditor group, despite the substantial opposition. The policy is adopted. There are substantial haircuts, as you can see here. So this is all of the debt outstanding. It's trading at about 40 cents on the dollar in 1788. An assumption is put in place in August of 1790. People don't trust it for a while, but as you can see, what essentially happens is that the average haircut, there are lots of different kinds of debt, so you can't draw. But the average haircut's about 20 cents, 20%. Right. And this outstanding debt starts trading at the recognized value very quickly, and the federal government again gets access to international and domestic financial markets for the first time really since the revolution begins. So the problem is solved. We have monetary stability and fiscal and financial stability. We have a stable currency. We have a government able to borrow both internationally and domestically, and everything's in its place, everything as it should be, but not so fast. This remains a controversial set of policies because the country is growing very rapidly, and people in the rapidly growing regions of the country believe, probably rightly, that the policies put in place by Hamilton are restraining their ability to grow. That is, the restrictive monetary policies are limiting the access to credit, and the restrictive financial policies are limiting the ability of the states to borrow to build infrastructure, which they need for the needs of the rapidly growing frontier regions. So in 1811, the Congress refuses to renew the charter of the central bank, and the bank goes out of business in 1811. Very poorly planned, because in 1812, the country embarks on an ill-fated attempt to annex Canada, which leads to the War of 1812, which we lose, and the capital gets burned, and all sorts of other terrible things happen. Because there is no central bank, and because the ability of the government to affect its monetary conditions and to run a fiscal policy has now been savaged by the refusal to renew the charter, what you have instead is bankruptcies of the states and rip-roaring inflation. So once the War of 1812 is over in 1815, the Congress rectifies its previous error, that is, in 1816, it recharters a new central bank. And this is the second bank. And it's a different building. It just looks like the same. All these bank buildings look alike. They all look like the Bank of England, actually, in some ways. So the second bank of the United States is chartered in 1816. And in fact, the second bank is somewhat more sophisticated than the first bank. It's run by a very, very, very well-trained American banker named Nicholas Biddle, who was the founder of much of American central banking thinking and was very influential, actually, also in the thinking of people like Bagehot here in London, because his policies were explicitly articulated in the context of a rapidly growing and new republic. So it would look like the problems were solved again, but in fact the problems are only beginning, because economic conditions start changing very rapidly. In fact, the period from 1789 to 1815 is a pretty easy period in monetary and fiscal policy, because the Europeans are completely absorbed with the Napoleonic Wars. And so American economic policy doesn't really have that much to do. You can't borrow very much, so your access to funds is limited. Can't export very much, because the continent is embargoed for much of the period. So the U.S. is sort of left on its own devices, and the problems are there, but they're not so severe. After 1816, the problems, which are really more opportunities than problems, start to proliferate. The cotton gin is invented somewhere around 1798, 1800, which means that all of a sudden the South is available for the production of the world's most important raw material, cotton, and the South begins to boom. Meanwhile, canals are built, which open up what was then called the American West, which we would now call the American Midwest, opens it up for the production of grain, which can now be shipped profitably to Europe. So the American frontier begins to boom, and as it booms, as cotton and wheat production expands very dramatically, the frontier is pushed very rapidly westward from where it had previously been almost exclusively east of the Appalachians, that is, in the 250 miles from the coast. Within the space, starting really in 1820, it moves almost 15 to 20 miles a year. It moves all the way west of the Mississippi by the 1830s. So this is the period in which there is extraordinarily rapid growth on the American frontier. And that creates a series of problems, because the very rapidly growing areas begin to chafe at the bit of the restrictive monetary policies put in place by the Second Bank. In other words, there are very substantial divergences in the macroeconomic conditions faced by the different regions of the country. The traditional established Northeast is stable and growing at 2, 3, 5% a year, while the South and Midwest, we would call it now, is growing much more rapidly and has a very, very different set of economic and political goals. This is a national bank note issued by the Second Bank of the United States, just to give you a sense of what it looks like. The result of this macroeconomic divergence is the bank wars. This is a picture from a supporter of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson is the fellow at the left who is trying to slay the multi-headed serpent of the creditor classes, which includes people like Peel and the Rothschilds and the Crown of England and all sorts of other international and domestic bankers. Again, the backdrop to this is very rapid growth in the periphery. Jackson is from a frontier state, Tennessee, and great macroeconomic divergency. The periphery wants loose money and pro-debtor policies. They want to be able to borrow at much lower rates. They want to be able to, they're concerned about what at the time is called a shortage of money, that is, which means both a shortage of credit and actually a shortage of currency. Right? There's the second bank, the bank of the central bank, is restricting the issue of currency to currency backed by gold, so there is very little paper currency around. The needs of the periphery are for more and more currency, and the bank refuses to issue enough currency to meet the needs of the periphery. So this turns into a massive conflict between a pro-debtor, loose money, South and West and Midwest periphery, which is growing very rapidly, and a center which wants tight money and pro-creditor policies, and leads to a war over the bank. This is Andrew Jackson attacking the central bank. These are interests that regard the supporters of the bank as he says, a den of vipers and thieves, whom Jackson resolves to rout out, and in fact succeeds in routing out. Among those defenders of the bank are Daniel Webster, a representative from Massachusetts, who reflects the creditor interests. This is just an example of their propaganda. This is the effects of Jackson's specie circular. The specie circular is an attempt to drive the bank out of business. In 1836, it says that the government will not accept bank notes in payment for taxes or other government obligations, which means that creditors can't get paid back. There's a wave of bankruptcies. This is a debtor sitting in his home, unable to pay his debts, and the creditors at the door unable to collect on their debts. So this is the creditor view of Jackson's policies. What it's doing is making it impossible, because of its clamping down on the bank, it's making it impossible for the well-meaning creditors to extend credit to these poor debtors, and stopping, as Webster put it in that quote, stopping the wheels of credit from allowing commerce to go forward. So you have this battle between those who want easy money and a pro-debtor policy and the fast-growing periphery, and those who want recognition of debts, a pro-creditor policy, and tight monetary policy in the stable financial and commercial center. Is this relevant to today? Well, I was pointing out before that the Tea Party regards Andrew Jackson as its intellectual and political founding father. They regard his anti-central bank policies as the predecessor to their view. This poster on the right, which is put out by Rand Paul's supporters in the Tea Party, again, has a picture of Andrew Jackson and a quote from Andrew Jackson on its cover. This is one of their pamphlets. Somewhat more malevolent. On the left, this is one of these very, very right-wing, anti-Semitic populist groups who places the whole thing, the conflict between Jackson and the central bank, as Andrew Jackson versus the Jewish bankers, arguing that Alexander Hamilton actually was Jewish and his real name was Levine, and that on the other hand you had the Rothschilds and August Belmont, who was their representative in America. So Andrew, I mean, believe it or not, if you Google Andrew Jackson today, what you bring up is millions of tracts by the Tea Party and libertarians and others about the Federal Reserve and American, contemporary American monetary policy. So history, as they used to say about the Bourbon Kings, they forget nothing and they learn nothing. In any event, what's the result of the elimination, the refusal to renew the charter of the central bank? What you have is an end to regulation on bank establishment, which goes at the same time. The periphery wins, and there is a boom of easy money, especially in the frontier states. In 1830, the size of the dot is how many banks there are, as you can see. It's a little bit hard to tell, but what you can see, I think, pretty clearly, that in the 20 years after the bank charter is not renewed, that is, in this 20 years of what's called free banking, you have a massive expansion of banks in the fast-growing frontier states. Michigan and Wisconsin. Michigan and Wisconsin are here and here, right? So Wisconsin goes from having virtually no banks, and Michigan, you can't really see, but this is now over 11 banks, and there are actually 30. It goes from having a couple of banks to having a large number of banks. So for this free banking period is one in which it becomes very easy becomes very easy for banks to to allow the establishment of as many for states to allow the establishment of as many banks as they want with whatever regulation they want. So free banking, to be a little more subtle about it, what it actually does is it allows the states to define bank regulation. So in New York, free banking is very conservative. And New York free banks are very reasonable and they don't go out of business and they run very well. But on the frontier, in places like Georgia or Michigan or Indiana or Illinois, the states, which are entirely controlled by the pro-debtor easy money group that want rapid expansion, allow pretty much anyone to set up a bank. So in this era of free banking, those that wanted easy credit and light regulation and loose monetary policy got it. They got it by setting up, by allowing the establishment of banks that had essentially no reserve requirements in their states. Well, what did it mean? It meant that you could have the banknotes were now not issued by a central bank, because there is no central bank. The money of the country is notes issued by banks. Right, like the Bull's Head Bank of Western New York. And those banks, some of those banks maintained a pretty good reserve behind their banknote issue, and others maintained almost no reserve. Well, if you're a banker or a financier or someone else in the commercial classes and you want to figure out what you're going to do about these banknotes, you have to recognize that some of the banknotes are worth a dollar on the dollar, and some of them are worth a lot less than a dollar on the dollar. In other words, there is actually a very substantial and real monetary divergence among the states, where the money of some states is worth a dollar on the dollar, and the money of other states is worth a lot less than a dollar on the dollar. The way this was resolved in practice was that a series of publications, typically known as banknote reporters, sprang up by 1838 to tell people how much their banknotes were worth. You know, counterfeits were also a problem, but the rates of discount on the banknotes were important. Now, this is a little hard to read, but what you can see, Ohio is doing pretty well. So the discount on Ohio, again, the regulations are state specific, right? So you don't expect a big variation among the states. So I'm worrying about going over time. I'm talking as fast as I can, but I'll stop for a moment and say. So how did this actually work? A bank, let's call it the Bank of Illinois in Shawneetown, Illinois. The Bank of Illinois issues banknotes, and they start circulating. And it takes a while for people to figure out how much they're actually worth, because the Bank of Illinois in Shawneetown is not stupid. They take these banknotes and they ship them to New Hampshire, where no one's ever heard of this bank. And people in New Hampshire say, well, it's a dollar banknote. Maybe it's worth a dollar. And it takes a while for these banknotes to get redeemed and work their way back from New Hampshire to Illinois, at which point people realize they're not really worth a dollar. But that's the job of these banknote reporters, was to actually figure out how much these banknotes were worth so that the people in the know could trade them at their true value. So Ohio banknotes are trading at about a 6 or 7% discount. New York banknotes, New York is here. New York City banknotes, 0.5% discount, which is probably just a transaction cost. So they're basically at par. Illinois at 30% discounts. Okay, I think there are, what does it say? Oh, yes. Mississippi, Michigan, Arkansas, Wisconsin, the Iowa Territory, no sale. That is, they're worthless. No reasonable financial or commercial agent will pay for a Mississippi banknote. They're still being used in Mississippi, though. Right? So this is a little bit like company scrip issued by state chartered banks. And what it implies is that there. Oops, that's going ahead of myself. What it implies is that there really is a monetary divergence among the states, where the notes from the more stable or conservative states trade at par, and those from the less stable or reliable states trade at a substantial discount, and therefore have a much more expansionary monetary policy, right? Where the debts are being depreciated at a rapid rate. So this brings us to the fiscal side, right? So we have this monetary divergence. Much of the fiscal side is closely related to the monetary side, shades of, to some extent, European experience, because many of the reserve assets, the principal reserve assets of these state chartered banks are state bonds. So one of the reasons that New York state banks are reliable is that their reserves are held in New York state bonds, which are creditworthy. And one of the reasons that Mississippi state banks are not reliable is that their reserves are held in Mississippi state bonds, which no one trusts. which says something potentially of relevance to the renationalization of finance in Europe and what constitutes reliable reserves and so on and so forth. So now, talking about the fiscal side, the central bank, that is the second bank in the United States, constrains state borrowing in a variety of ways, both directly and indirectly. Without the central bank, the states are essentially free to borrow whatever they can, and they do. And starting in 1837, which is the first year after the bank charter expires, the states start borrowing enormous quantities. And again, there's a divergence. The states that are controlled by these debtor interests that want a rapid expansion and want easy money are the big borrowers. While the more conservative states, New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, borrow in much more conservative quantities. Now, what are they borrowing for? They're not borrowing for nothing. They're borrowing for a very big expansion of the country's infrastructure, canals and railroads. First canals, and eventually by the early 1840s, railroads. Most of the country's early canals and railroads are financed by borrowing. Most of that borrowing is from Europe. Right? So the Erie Canal is almost exclusively financed by Dutch investors. Right? Most of the first railroads are financed by British and Dutch investors. They're financed through state borrowing. These are not private borrowings. This is state borrowing, and it's the full faith and credit of the various states. The creditors say, this is safe. We know what happened back in 1790. We had all these states that were in default. The federal government stepped in and assumed them. And although they didn't know the words moral hazard, they say we know what moral hazard means. They know that if the federal government's going to bail out the states, then the federal government's full faith and credit, which is good now, stands behind the states. So foreign and domestic, but mostly foreign investors, are very, very willing to lend to these various states. This then leads to, again, since I am trying to draw some of the comparisons to the present day, this leads to something of an upward spiral. You have one region of the country that has easy monetary policies and is borrowing at a very, very rapid rate, but mostly states, but also borrowing on the private side, getting into a bigger and bigger boom. Right? So prices are rising in these states, incomes are rising, asset prices are rising, the banks are lending like crazy, they have very few reserves, but they're lending like crazy. The local monetary supply is expanding, local borrowing is expanding, both on the private account and on the state account. That then makes it more attractive to borrow further, and you get an upward spiral of increasing indebtedness and very rapid growth in the frontier, in Louisiana, in Mississippi, in Illinois, in Wisconsin, in Michigan. By 1841, state government debt is 12% of GDP, which doesn't sound like a lot, but again, this is a state government. So if you take all the state government's debt, it's 12% of GDP. Just as an example, state government debt today is 7% of GDP, and it's regarded as a big problem. Right? So we're talking about a state government debt that is a very substantial part of GDP. It's actually a lot bigger in some states. So this presages the story, but you can see the states on the right-hand side. We don't have GDP numbers. We have state income numbers. But you can see that some of the states have borrowed in the course of this borrowing boom that begins in 1836 or 37. By 1841, they have borrowed 36% of state income. Right. And sure.
When you say they're expanding, they're borrowing from abroad. They're borrowing in their own state currency.
Yes, they're borrowing in dollars. Pounds. No, they're borrowing in dollars. So all this is this. The American states were able to borrow it. This is part of the assumption issue, right? So they're borrowing in U.S. dollars on the principle that the federal government, which stands behind the dollar, right, will also stand behind the state debts. Right, so which is analogous, or not analogous to, but is different, is analogous to Portugal borrowing in euros, but is different from Brazil borrowing in reals, right? Unless you believe that the real is as good as gold. So what this presages what actually happens. What happens is, starting in 1841, some of the states start defaulting. As your timeline indicates, there are eight states in a territory that eventually default. The territory is Florida, which becomes a state during this period. And in fact, of those nine, five actually repudiate their debts. That is, they don't just say, we're going to have to renegotiate these debts. They say, we do not recognize the validity of these debts. right? Which might seem strange, but as you'll see in just a moment, they actually get away with it. Right. There's no legal standing for this repudiation, by the way. It's just a repudiation on the basis of that they don't recognize that they're worth paying. The markets react, so these are the bonds of defaulting states. They go up to a 40% discount, or the yield goes up to 40% in 1842. And then some of them are renegotiated. As defaulting states are renegotiated, the creditors take a major haircut. It's been variously, the states vary, right? And John Wallace has figured out what the internal rate of return ends up being. I think the average haircut is, again, about 25%. Right, because these defaulting states do renegotiate. Some states never default. The majority of states never default. Right? And surprisingly, I think, to the creditors, there is no federal assumption. The creditor, the politics of this, again, are the majority of states are not in default, and when it gets to Congress, there is an attempt, especially in the House of Representatives, to have the federal government assume the state debts. But largely because of the overrepresentation of more conservative small states like Rhode Island and New Hampshire and Maine, which are on the creditor side, that is turned down, and the federal government does not assume the state debts. There is no bailout. All right, so there's no bailout in the 1840s. Some of the states, this is Mississippi, and this is a couple of pages from the annual report of the Council of the Corporation of Foreign Bondholders, based right here in London, reporting on its sorry attempts to get its money back from the 1830s borrowing of the Mississippi. These are Mississippi state-owned banks that borrowed money. And I haven't ever bothered to figure this out, but I think that in net present value terms, this is probably $5 trillion that's accrued over the last 180 years or something. The Corporation of Foreign Bondholders has continued up to its dissolution in 1988 to send a letter every year to the governor of the state of Mississippi requesting discussions, but as it says there on the lower right-hand corner, no reply was received. And the reason no reply was received is that after the debt crisis, the state of Mississippi adopted a new constitution, and the constitution makes it unconstitutional for any member of the Mississippi government or any representative of the Mississippi government to have any contact with the creditors of those defaulted bonds. Right? So those bonds will not be paid, I think. Anyway, that's the story of Mississippi debt. Finally, in 1863, both issues are resolved. And they are resolved with the passage of the National Banking Act of 1863. The National Banking Act of 1863 sets up a single issuer of banknotes, which is the Independent Treasury. The Independent Treasury starts to operate more or less like a central bank. It isn't until 1913 that the Northeast can finally get a central bank set up, but the Independent Treasury is acting like a central bank. So you have unified national banknotes. Now, you'll see here, this says the First National Bank of Livonia. The way they squared the circle was by saying everybody has to issue all national banks. Now, to be a bank now, you have to have a national charter. The national banks have to have a stable reserve in treasuries or gold with the independent treasury. They can issue their own banknotes. On one side, it says full faith and credit of the U.S. government backed by gold. On the other side, you can put your own bank's name. But these are essentially national banknotes backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Just for the interest of those present and the couple of Americans perhaps present, the reason this is an incredibly important banknote is that anybody know? Can anybody tell? Look at the signature on the right. Ty Cobb is one of the greatest and most famous American baseball players, and he was the honorary president of the Bank of Livonia, Georgia, which was his hometown. So this is a collector's item because it's signed. It's actually signed by Ty Cobb. Right? In any event, so now you have national banknotes under the National Banking Act of 1863, and because of the non-assumption of state debts over the course of the 1840s and 50s and going on further, the states find themselves they're in a new environment. They're not going to be bailed out. They have to work out their finances. And pretty much all of the states, and especially all of the defaulting states, rewrite their constitutions to put in more conservative fiscal policies. And that's the origin, some of you will know, about the balanced budget amendments or other fiscal and financial requirements of the state. So the state's realizing that they no longer have an implicit bailout guarantee from the federal government, say, okay, we're on our own hook. How are we going to manage this? And they put in place a variety of different measures. For example, that you have to run a balanced budget over an average of 5 years. You separate a capital and a current account. The current account has to always be in balance. The capital account can be in deficit for 3 years running or something along those lines. A whole series of measures by which the states take seriously their obligation to service their debts because they realize they will not be bailed out by the federal government. To point out, and I'm getting close to getting to the present day, to point out, it is not coincidence that it is in 1863 that all this is done. In 1863, the South is out of the Congress because the South has seceded. And the formerly loose money, easy credit, frontier, rapidly expanding region that is the strongest supporters of these pro-debtor, easy money policies are now not represented. And the government is being run by the North. So it is easy for the northern representatives to say, enough of this nonsense, now we're going to put in place our policies. By the way, the other thing that the North and the South disagree on is the tariff, the South being a primary exporting region, producing cotton for world markets and importing its finished goods, wants free trade. The North wants trade protection because it is the industrializing region of the country. And until the Civil War, the South predominates and tariffs are relatively low. The first act of the new Congress after the Southern representatives get up and leave is to declare war on the South, and the second act is to raise the tariff. And one of its other acts is to adopt the National Banking Act. We're still not fully there, and if anyone's interested, I can talk about the battles that go on after the 1860s, because there is still a fundamental division of the country between an easy money policy, and those some of you will know William Jennings Bryan and the battles over the gold standard, which is a similar kind of division that goes on really from the 1870s all the way up through the 1930s. Okay. History. What are the lessons? And I told you, David, it would take way too long, but I'm going to try briefly to talk about what to me the lessons, some of the lessons of this may be. The simplest lesson is to use the words, or paraphrase the words of Abraham Lincoln, that you can't satisfy all the people all the time. That there are many definitions of what constitutes an appropriate monetary policy, an appropriate regime. The first principle of political economy is, as we say, where you stand depends on where you sit. And people sit in different parts of the economy, both regionally and sectorally, or in terms of income group or class. On monetary policy, finding a monetary policy for a federal union of any sort, or really for any country that is not made up of one undifferent. Most countries, by the way, in early macro, and even some contemporary macro, are made up of one infinitely lived individual. That's the way you solve this problem. But most real countries are not made up of one infinitely lived individual. They're made up of groups of people who have divergent interests. And so finding a monetary policy that it can adapt itself to the divergent interests of these various groups is of great political difficulty. And, you know, to stylize somewhat the kinds of interests that we run into, on the one hand, you have those who might favor a strong dollar with low rates of inflation. These would be people in the creditor classes, commercial and financial groups, those who would benefit from a strong dollar, those who would benefit from low inflation. And then you have others who would benefit from a weak dollar with relatively high inflation rates, which might be people like farmers, manufacturers, and debtors. And this is as true today as it was in the past. I think I've said to David before, you know, I give talks about contemporary American economic policy issues, and, you know, given the nature of talks to the general community in the United States, at least, I'd say the average or the median member of the audience is a retiree, because who else has time to go to these talks? And the most common comment made at these talks in the last 5 years has been, how do these people expect us to live with such low interest rates? Because retirees in America, given that most retirees depend on a mix of Social Security and on private pension funds, that is, on private savings, have gotten used over the past 20 years, or had gotten used, to 5 to 7% annual rates of return. And now they're lucky to be getting a positive real rate of return. They're lucky to be getting 2% at a time when inflation is 2 or 2.5%. And they are hurting. This is a real hardship for large groups of the population. It is not a coincidence that the average age of Tea Party members is 62. And it is not a coincidence that their economic policy platform has, first and foremost, cut everything that you can in the federal budget except for Medicare and Social Security. So these divisions on monetary policy persist, as they of course do within the European Union, between regions that are rapidly growing and want easier money and those that are let's say, more stable. On fiscal policy, again, policy towards debts and towards economic adjustment, this is a highly political environment. And as many of you will know, there's the macro presentation of the adjustment process starts from the principle that there is an asymmetry of the adjustment burden. So if you think of existing debt burden that has to be adjusted to, the macroeconomic approach will say, this adjustment burden is asymmetric because surplus countries, the creditors, think of surplus and deficit countries. Surplus countries don't really have to adjust. It's not such a big deal to adjust. Deficit countries have to adjust. If you can't borrow, you have no choice. If you think of it in terms of households, a household that is running a deficit that can't borrow anymore has no choice but to adjust. A country that is running a deficit and can't borrow anymore has no choice and has to adjust. So that's the macro view, but it's a purely economic view. And it leaves out the political aspect, which is that where there may be an economic asymmetry in the adjustment burden, there is also a political response. Because in every instance I know of in which there is this adjustment problem, the debtors or the deficit actors, whether they are groups or countries, immediately engage the political process to try to exact a political restructuring of their debts. There has been, I've talked with Ken Rogoff and Cameron Wright about this, and we think we're right, that there has never been a debt crisis, of international debt. There has never been a debt crisis that did not lead to a restructuring of the debts. That is, there has never been a debt crisis in which, and this is where I think David got his title, in which the creditors didn't end up giving up something, even though, from a purely economic standpoint, they hold the whip hand. But holding the whip hand economically means nothing when your debtors can actually credibly threaten to default on their debts and can use either international borrowing or domestic politics to try to exact a restructuring of those debts. There's a difference between the U.S. and the EU. In the EU, a lot of these debts are, in fact, international. In the case of the U.S., a lot of the debtor problems historically have been either interstate or intersectoral. And, go back to the 1930s and read your John Steinbeck. What happened with the debtor communities in those circumstances was that either through social action or political action, those debts eventually, large portions of those debts, and the principal debts that were in default at the time were farm debts, large portions of those farm debts were either defaulted upon and through either state action, local state action, or federal action, it became illegal or impossible for the creditors to seize assets in payment of those debts, or those debts were restructured and assumed by the federal government, or a haircut was forced on the creditors.
Is it illegal now, Chapter 9, for example,
Well, there's a whole series. Well, it's not only illegal. States cannot. Without getting into too many, we can talk about the details in a bit. States can't legally default in the U.S., which is a little bit of a misstatement. Legally, states cannot be sued by citizens. Right. So, if you can't be sued by a citizen, then essentially you can't default. But municipalities and counties can. And so the response to the legal circumstances in which states can't legally default is that most of the riskier borrowing is done by municipalities, counties, and then state agencies, which are allowed to default. So the defaults that have happened since the 1840s have been defaults of, like, whoops, you know, the Washington Power Supply System, which is an independent state agency. Right. The Metropolitan Transit Authority has defaulted. That's an agency of the three states, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. A variety of state agencies default, but states themselves don't default because there's this legal...
But Puerto Rico is exceptional.
Puerto Rico has all sorts of exceptional things because it's in this unique circumstance. Yeah, yeah. I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand all the legalities of this. Pardon me?
Many investors who have Puerto Rico paper are just in misery because they can't see the way out.
Right, right. I think the general point is, which is illustrated by this, that whatever you may think creditor rights are in an environment, there is always some political mechanism or some political way in which debtors, who tend to be more numerous than creditors, can use the political system to try to achieve a restructuring that is more in their interest than what would be achieved in a purely economic sense. Right? I wanted to make a couple of broader related points. First, on monetary policy, that is that designing a monetary policy for a disparate union will always be political. There is unlikely to be one optimal policy for any country, really, but certainly for a very disparate union. Going back to the 1990s, many of you will remember, there were debates among economists over whether Europe was an optimal currency area using the definitions that were then in play. And the universal conclusion was that it wasn't, that the macroeconomic divergences were too great, that the labor mobility was too low, that the level of diversification was too low, so it wasn't an optimal currency area. But then Tambayumi and Barry Eichengreen and others started saying, well, is the U.S. an optimal currency area? And it turns out that by the standards of the optimal currency area literature, the U.S. isn't an optimal currency area either, right? That is, the macroeconomic divergences are too great. The level of labor mobility, although it's greater than in Europe, is too low. The level of diversification, if you think of sort of Texas and Louisiana are the oil patch. Their economies rise and fall on oil prices, and the rest of the country is running counter-cyclically. So even the U.S. is not an optimal currency area. And the broader point is that there is always going to be a political debate over the appropriate monetary policy for a disparate economic union. And the challenge is to understand the pressures on the monetary authorities and the ways in which they respond to those pressures. The second, having to do with debt, financial policy, fiscal policy, is that, as I was just saying, recovery from a debt crisis is always political. Every debt crisis gets thrown into the political arena, and the issue that gets addressed is who will bear the burden of adjustment, whether within countries or across countries. It's easy to see when you're talking about austerity or restructuring, when you're talking about a debtor country or a debtor class, whatever it may be, because no one likes to adjust, no one likes austerity. These two dimensions of debate obviously are seen very clearly in the European Union, where on the one hand you have the debtor countries arrayed against the creditor countries, but they're also seen within countries in the European Union, where within Greece or within Germany there's a question of who's going to be bearing the adjustment burden, who in Greece is going to be servicing, making the sacrifices necessary to service their debt, who in Germany is going to be making the sacrifices necessary to hold up Germany's part of the deal. Right? Adjustment can't be unilateral. Right. This is another point that often gets lost in some of the European debates. If deficit countries are going to be able to repay their debts, they have to stop running deficits and start running surpluses, and that means that the surplus countries have to stop running surpluses. There is typically as much political support for and as entrenched political support for being a surplus country as there is for being a deficit country. So I would point out that that adjustment is not only difficult for deficit countries. It's obvious why it's difficult for deficit countries or for deficit groups, because they have to engage in austerity, they have to reduce consumption, increase savings, and that's rarely pleasant. But it's also difficult for surplus countries for the same kinds of political and political economy reasons. And without talking about Europe, we can think about China, another big surplus country. For over 30 years, the Chinese economy and its political economy have been single-mindedly organized around generating surpluses, around producing manufactured goods for exports to the rest, for export to the rest of the world. My China scholar friends tell me the Central Committee and the Politburo are dominated by representatives of the major manufacturing exporting regions in the coastal regions, that the whole political system is dominated by these interests, and that asking them to turn the economy around so that it relies more on domestic consumption, less on exports, more on domestic expansion, is extraordinarily difficult. The Chinese government has said for over 10 years that it wants to increase the share of consumption in national income. And for over 10 years, the share of consumption in national income has continued to decline. Not stabilize, but decline. To where it's now around 30 or 33%, I think, when last heard of. The lowest level, leaving aside, I suppose, North Korea or something, the lowest level in almost any country in the world. So despite its efforts, it has been extraordinary. And I believe that the central government in China would like to increase consumption, would like to reorient the economy more away from reliance on exports and reliance on domestic consumption.
Solomon Islands, actually, is the one.
What's the word?
Solomon Islands.
Ah.
Is the one which has the lower
consumption. Oh, lower consumption. Okay. Solomon Islands, okay. They've been in the news lately for a couple of reasons. They're the ones that were put on, this is really arcane, but remember the Coalition of the Willing?
Yes.
So the Bush administration put out a list of the Coalition of the Willing, and Solomon Islands was on it, but they apparently hadn't been consulted. So they wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times, right? Say an email saying, excuse me, but we are not a member of the Coalition of the Willing. Anyway, in any event. So that's about adjustment more generally, that the adjustment problem is severe in surplus countries as it is in deficit countries, and this is something we saw in the U.S. as well when debts had to be adjusted to. But there's in the European Union, and I think in the world more generally, the issue is not just a one-off restructuring of existing debts. It's an attempt to create and one hopes sustain an ongoing relationship, whether in the U.S., in the Federal Union, or in the European Union. So that really implicates the very nature of the relationship between the regions in the U.S. or between the countries within the EU. In the U.S., much of the 19th century, including the period I haven't talked about, that is from the 1860s up into 1913 and beyond, really until the 1930s, the issue was what terms would the relationship between the more stable, conservative, creditor Northeast and the West and Southwest be? Whether in terms of monetary policy or in terms of attitude towards debt, that is, how will Chapter 9 and Chapter 11 be written and how will they be implemented? Will we have a more debtor-friendly or a more creditor-friendly environment? Will we have a central bank, and will that central bank be representative of all the regions, or it will be controlled by New York? Right. All of these issues were front and center in the American political economy, not only in the period I've talked about, but then again from the 1860s until the 1930s or even until the 1950s. And they still remain important. Right? What is the underlying political economy of the division of labor and the division of responsibilities, the terms of trade among the regions of a country like the United States or within the Eurozone, the countries of the Eurozone or in the world? Between deficit and surplus countries. So, conclusions. From the American experience, crafting a union of any sort is a long, hard road, not for technical difficulties, technical reasons, because Alexander Hamilton, my hero, solved them all. Right? He knew what the answer was. He knew how to create a functioning federal union. But he faced politically unsustainable compromises. Right? And it took the country 80 years to arrive at even a first cut at politically sustainable compromises, which then were continually challenged for the next 80 years. And one might have said that by the 1950s, we, the United States, had arrived at a sustainable set of economic compromises over macroeconomic policy, fiscal policy, financial policy, the role of the states and the federal government. In the last 5 years, those compromises have again been called into question, but I think they're probably sustainable. It took the U.S. a long time, and the current turmoil indicates that even in the U.S., the compromise may not be stable. So I think it's no surprise that for the European Union, the concluding chapter is nowhere close to being written.